the place. Space is the place, yeah. Space is the place. Calling planet Earth, space is the place.
This is KBOO Portland.
You are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your Portland dial, KBOO.FM on your everywhere on earth internet dial. Stay safe, stay sane, stay tuned. KBOO, the best in community radio.
KBOO is in the middle of our annual spring membership drive. It's that time of year where KBOO is all abuzz, and we need you to come jive with our radio hive. Help us reach our $56,000 goal and keep the hive alive. Just go to kboo.fm/give or mail a check to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And thanks.
You are listening to KBO Portland 90.7 on your FM dial. Welcome to Talking Earth. Usually in this slot, you would be hearing Barbara Lamorticella with a new poetry show. Due to health reasons, Barbara will be taking a break from recording shows for 4 to 6 months. She is fine. I just spoke to her just before recording this right now, but she would like a vacation for a little while. Tonight, we will be airing one of her favorite shows in the last 2 years, a tribute to underrated beat poet Bob Kaufman, which originally aired in February of last year, 2021. Please enjoy.
This is Barbara Lamorticella, and this is Talking Earth on KBOO Radio. Tonight, I'll be sharing some of the work of the poet Bob Kaufman with his editor and friend Ray Foy. Kaufman is a unique figure in the canon of American literature. He was a black man who was both political and, I would argue, spiritual, and who was repeatedly beaten, jailed, institutionalized, and administered electric shock treatments. These experiences damaged him physically, but each time he was discharged to the street, his resolution to remain true to himself grew stronger. Kaufman was born in New Orleans, one of 13 children of a Jewish father and a Catholic Afro-Caribbean mother. His grandmother was said to have practiced voodoo and to have come to the U.S. from Martinique on a slave ship. Kaufman crossed the sea many times. He got his mariner's license as a young teenager and spent the next 7 years working as a mariner. He was known and respected by everyone he sailed with as being brave and willing to do the hardest and most dangerous jobs. In July of 1945, at 20, he was appointed chairman of the rank-and-file National Maritime Union Strike Mobilization Committee. This was the era of the McCarthy witch hunts, and in April of 1947, he published two letters in the Maritime Union's newspaper, one denouncing what he called the present hysterical campaign against the Communist Party by the House Committee on Un-American Activities, and the other making proposals for the upcoming Maritime Union contract. He was also reported in the paper to have given a shipboard talk about the menace of Franco Spain. From that moment on, he was a marked man, spied on by the FBI, thrown out and blackballed by the Maritime Union, and refused renewal of his Coast Guard card. The height of McCarthyism was also the height of the beatnik era. Banned from the seaman's work he loved, while working on land as a cook at the Ritz-Carlton in Los Angeles, Coffin read an article in Life magazine about beatniks and moved to San Francisco. A brilliant, tormented, and stubborn man, in San Francisco he adopted the public role that was denied him in the Union. He was an American Romy. He was a bard who loved jazz. In the city, he jumped up on tables in coffee shops to recite the poems of the many poets he loved and memorized, immediately followed by improvising his own poems in a kind of verbal jazz. When he did write down his words, it was mostly on napkins, paper bags, or scraps of paper that he would pull out of his pocket and drop when he was done. It was as if he was trying to erase himself. But crowds began to gather and camp out in the coffee shops he was known to hang out in, hoping that he might show up. And he quickly became a North Beach celebrity. In 1959, San Francisco had two cops on the beat in North Beach called the Beatnik Squad. One, William Bigorani, saw himself as a warrior in a cultural war. He hated beatniks and, given the slightest pretext, arrested them. He once arrested a 20-year-old woman at the coexistent bagel shop because she was barefoot after a sandal broke. The poet A.D. Winans, who knew him in high school, said Bigorani had always been a racist, and Kaufman, who was black, loud, and had a white wife, became a particular target. In the summer of 1959, during the height of the beatnik popularity, Bigorani arrested Kaufman 39 times for disturbing the peace. He was jailed so often that North Beach coffee shops put out cans for people to donate Kaufman bail money. While in jail, having no way to perform his poems, Kaufman began writing them on paper, some long and some short. Jail poem 19 reads, "Sitting here writing things on paper instead of sticking the pencil in the air." When he got out of prison, he and a fellow poet named William Margolis posted anti-cop poems in the window of the Coexistence Bagel Shop. Kaufman's poem, Jail Poem 23, read, "One day Adolf Hitler had nothing to do. All the Jews were burned, artists all destroyed. Adolf Hitler was very bored, even with Eva. So he moved to San Francisco, became an ordinary policeman, devoted himself to stamping out beatniks." Bigorani stormed into the bagel shop at 2 a.m. and ripped the poems down. The Associated Press sent a reporter whose story, "San Francisco officer fed up with beatniks," made the national news. The ACLU held a press conference, and the ACLU's Al Bendick told the press, "This looks like a clear violation of freedom of speech." Attorney Lawrence Spicer advised the poets to put their poems up all over North Beach, which they did. Then Kaufman and Margolis wandered up and down Grant Avenue, with Bigorani nowhere to be seen. Joke Kaufman, "Isn't that the way? You can never find a policeman when you need one." Officer Bigorani was defended in the September 1959 newsletter of the San Francisco Police Officers Association. Those who criticized the police for tearing down the poems, Union Secretary Peter Gardner wrote, "have never had personal contact with the beatniks and do not know the real picture on Upper Grant Avenue. The people who frequent the area hate other things besides policemen. They hate work, industry, and conformity with the rules which govern society. They are typical of the pseudo-intellectual element found in an intellectual slum. The beatniks sit around the various beer and wine dives at all hours of the day and deride any hard-working effort. They create a police problem because of their attitude. Policemen bug them because they keep them from doing whatever comes into their heads, whenever they feel like doing it, whether it be by day or night. Every time Bigoroni and his partner made an arrest, Gardner wrote, a crowd of loafers make caustic remarks and put the officers to the test in any way they can. Kaufman is a regular at the city prison with numerous vagrancy arrests to his name, Gardner continued. Yet he and his dandy friends can write and post garbage which maligns and libels Bigoroni, and he is supposed to take it with a smile. He didn't, and I say it was damn fine police work. But Police Chief Thomas Cahill knew the courts wouldn't agree and directed the forts to allow the poems to stay up. The beatniks won this battle, but after this, the police harassment intensified. In January of 1960, police and state agents launched Bigoroni's Revenge, a drug sweep in North Beach that made 23 arrests, mostly for marijuana possession. In response, 300 beatniks turned out to protest. But that year saw the end of the most vital period of the North Beach poetry scene. In October of 1960, the Coexistence Bagel Shop closed. Its owner's parting words were, I'm sick of having to deal with a sick city administration and a psychopathic police department. I'm tired of San Francisco and I never want to see it again. Kaufman, who had lost his hearing and several teeth after being beaten by racists in the South while working as a labor organizer, was clubbed in the head by San Francisco police. In 1960, he moved to New York with his wife Eileen and his baby son Parker, named for Charlie Parker. But the poverty and arrests continued, and in 1962, Eileen and Parker returned to San Francisco. In 1963, as Kaufman prepared to move back to join them, he was arrested in New York, reportedly for walking on the grass in Washington Square. Not an obedient prisoner, he was transferred from jail to Bellevue Psychiatric Hospital, where he was administered electric shock treatments. When he was released and rejoined Eileen and Parker, he was not the same. In 1964, James Baldwin declared, there's no moral distance between the facts of life in San Francisco and the facts of life in Birmingham. As with Rumi, Kaufman's spontaneous improvisations were transcribed, often by his wife Eileen. The poems he threw down were picked up by others and sent to magazines, and New Directions in New York persuaded Eileen to put together a volume, Solitude Crowded with Loneliness, that she compiled and edited. It was published in 1965. Working with her on it, Kaufman became addicted to methamphetamine. It was years before he was able to break his addiction. When President Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, Kaufman took a vow that he would be silent until after the Vietnam War ended. In an effort to support Parker and their household, his hard-pressed wife compiled Golden Sardine, a volume of the poems she had salvaged and transcribed. Edited by Mary Beach, it was published by City Lights in 1967 in its Pockets Poets series and instantly attained national and international fame. By Ray Foy's arrival in San Francisco in 1977, Kaufman had become what Foy described as a visible but otherworldly, specter-like figure. It's possible that the electroshock treatments, combined with his drinking and addiction, were responsible for his actions in the last years of his life. He had given up drugs, but developed a pattern of 6 to 8 month periods of silence and sobriety, followed by 6 to 8 months of drunken street performances, sometimes jumping on the hoods of cars to declaim. The last book published in Kaufman's lifetime, The Ancient Rain, Poems 1956 to 1978, was composed of poems literally dug out of the debris of a fire by Ray Foy. Ray had to twist Kaufman's arm to be allowed to send the manuscript out. It was published by New Directions in 1981. Foy then successfully applied for a $12,500 NEA grant for Kaufman, who couldn't believe the check was real when it came. Within a month, he had generously sprinkled every poet in North Beach with cash, spruced up his wardrobe, and was broke again. Unpredictable, mercurial, and elusive, Kaufman's life was the stuff of legend. His work was spontaneous and improvisational word jazz. He was a groundbreaker in the school that Amiri Baraka would later label Afro-Surrealism. He was inspired by and inspired all the heavyweights of the Beat Generation. He was famous in Europe, and his death in 1986 was marked by poetry readings all over the world. There's an alley visited by tourists in San Francisco officially named Bob Kaufman Alley. But Kaufman, the Jewish, Catholic, Voodoo, Buddhist, Communist, anarchist, doesn't hold the place he deserves in the pantheon of American literary figures. In an effort to rectify this, in 2019, City Lights gathered together all three books published in Kaufman's lifetime, together with uncollected poems recovered after his death, and published Collected Poems of Bob Kaufman, edited by Neerli Cherkovsky, Raymond Foy, and Tate Swindell. Editor Ray Foy came online with me a few nights ago to read some of Kaufman's poems and talk about the poet's life in the San Francisco years. But before we go to this conversation, I'd like to read a couple of his poems. True to his promise, he stayed silent until the Vietnam War ended, neither performing nor apparently writing. When the war ended in 1973, he burst into an art gallery opening, reciting poetry by William Blake and Charles Olson, and excerpts from Murder in the Cathedral, a verse play by T.S. Eliot, followed by a poem of his own that I see as a kind of elegy for John F. Kennedy and for the brilliant dreams of the 60s that were crushed. He called the poem All Those Ships That Never Sailed. It began, "All those ships that never sailed, the ones with their sea cocks open that were scuttled in their stalls. Today I bring them back, huge and intransitory, and let them sail forever. All those flowers that you never grew, that you wanted to grow, the ones that were plowed under, ground in the mud, today I bring them back and let you grow them forever." In his early years, Kaufman had been exposed to Judaism, Catholicism, and Voodoo. He described himself as an atheist, but the God he rejected was the God of Judaism and the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. He was always a seeker of God, in search of the mysteries. He lived his life as though he had taken a monastic vow of poverty and a Buddhist vow of silence. In his last years, he became a Zen Buddhist, practicing the discipline of allowing his thoughts to flow through his mind without being attached to them. But he resonated with the spirit of Christ as a suffering man and with the green spirit of earth, more akin to nature religions, to the mother goddess, and perhaps to voodoo. Here's a poem from Ancient Rain that preceded a poem about Oregon. "My mysteries created for me by God are unknown to me, yet I live each one perfectly. God is my green-eyed one, whose power is endless. I ask God, O God, to the coward give a horse, that he may flee God forever. Give Cain no forgiveness for what was done. I ask God, my green-eyed one, before this earth stops spinning, think of me. Remember, I am here too, my green-eyed one, whose power is endless. After what was done to you, what forgiveness? Oh, God, my green-eyed one, come upon the earth and strike the globe with your wrath for what has died in the sun. Oh, God, my green-eyed one, put your sharp stars in the sky. Send Orion, the hunter's star, to hunt the killers of the dream, to hunt the slayers of the divine incunabula. Oh, my green-eyed one, before this earth stops spinning. The green-eyed one, a ship of dreams that sails forever. I'll end with a poem from Golden Sardine called Waiting. Somewhere there waits, waiting, a book is waiting, waiting to be written. Cold, cold pages waiting to be written. Man seeks God in a book. Somewhere there waits, waiting, a picture waits, waiting, waiting to be painted. Cold, cold canvas, canvas, waiting to be painted. Man seeks God in a picture. Somewhere there waits, waiting, a woman waiting, waiting to be loved, waiting. Cold, cold woman, waiting to be loved. Man seeks God in a woman. Somewhere there waits, waiting, a man is waiting, waiting. Cold, cold man waiting to be wanted, waiting. Man seeks God in man. Somewhere there waits, waiting, a baby is waiting, waiting. Waiting, waiting to be born. Cold, cold baby, waiting to be born. Blood of earth, waiting to be. Man seeks God in a baby. Wind, sea, sky, stars surround us. And now, a conversation with Ray Foy, who loved Kaufman's work from the time he first read him as a teenager and became his editor, helper, and friend. With me tonight from Woodstock, New York, is Ray Foy. Ray is an editor, a writer, a publisher of poets, both famous and unrecognized, an archivist, and a lover of art and poetry, particularly the poets of the wild poetry of the San Francisco Beatnik Renaissance. Ray loved
Bob Kaufman's work from the first time he stumbled upon a book of Kaufman's in a comic shop when he was only 14 years old. He wasn't exactly a stranger to beat literature. His father played football with Jack Kerouac, and his mother was a secretary to the editor of the Lowell, Massachusetts paper where Kerouac wrote a sports column. And her desk was right across from Kerouac's. His was a patriotic, working-class Irish Catholic family, and he was gay. Perhaps that's why he was drawn so early to the beatniks, who rejected mainstream American culture and broke the bond of the conventionally accepted literature of his time. Ray has remained true his whole life to Bob Kaufman and the poets he loved, lived with, listened to, and befriended in San Francisco. Welcome, Ray.
Thank you very much, Barbara.
You have written that you were smitten with Bob Kaufman from the first page of Solitude Crowded with Loneliness that you opened in a comic book store. It spoke of sorrow in an imaginary forest where a shingled hippo becomes a gay unicorn. I imagine it may have been the sorrow, the surrealism, but also the gay hippo that galvanized you to the point where you sought out his second book of poems and carried both with you on the shelves with his photo facing out for the next few years while you attended several art schools until you wound up in the San Francisco Art Institute when you were 19. You ran into your hero, Bob Kaufman, on the street very soon after arriving in San Francisco. Do you want to tell us about that first meeting?
Yes. I had just chosen at random a hotel called the Tavir Hotel, which was on a little triangle that was formed by Columbus Avenue and Grant Avenue and Vallejo Street. And got a room that was $19 a week and checked in, decided to head out to explore the neighborhood. I knew it was the neighborhood where the Beat Poets hung out. City Lights Books was only a block away. So as I'm walking down the steps of the hotel, this gentleman is passing me by on the stairs, and there was kind of a shock of recognition. And as he passed me, I thought to myself, my God, that's Bob Kaufman. This was the face I'd been looking at on books for years. And as he passed me by, I turned and I said to him, are you Bob Kaufman? And without stopping, he said, sometimes. And he kept going. And I thought, well, there you have it. The first of many mysterious and enigmatic encounters.
Well, in the afterword of the book of collected poems, you very, very beautifully described him in that year. That was 1977. And already he had entered a phase where he was fading away in some ways, and then he would burst out again. But you said that you never met anyone whose presence was more defined by absence than Kaufman, and that he was almost a ghost-like presence on the streets in those years. And that had a history to it. And the history was that he had been not only as a young man in the South, in Louisiana, where he was beaten by police, locked up in an ice house, hung up by his thumbs, beaten by the police for being a union organizer. But in San Francisco, he was singled out by a cop named William Bigarani, who beat him savagely over the head, picked him up repeatedly for the crime of, which he did, jumping up on tables in various cafes and declaiming poetry. Well, Bigarani would take him off to jail. Most of the work we're going to be hearing tonight is from a collection which exists only because of you, Ray, because you rescued it. but I thought we might open with some poems that preceded this period in 77 when you began your encounters with him. And they were poems that he wrote in jail, the jail poems. Can you read?
Yes. This is one of my very favorite compositions of Bob's. And they start out with kind of longish poems, and then they kind of begin to get pared down to couplets and, in some cases, single lines.
I'm wondering if you could read the first three ones, to set it up.
Yes, all right. Jail poems, one. I am sitting in a cell with a view of evil parallels, waiting thunder to splinter me into a thousand me's. It is not enough to be in one cage with oneself. I want to sit opposite every prisoner in every hole. Doors roll and bang, every slam a finality, bang. A junkie disappeared into a red noise, stoning out his hell. The odored wino congratulates himself on not smoking. Fingerprints left on the black, inky gravestones. Noises of pain seeping through steel walls, crashing, reaching my own hurt. I become part of someone forever. Wild accents of criminals are sweeter to me than hum of cops. Busy battening down hatches of human souls. Cargo destined for ports of accusations, harbors of guilt. What do policemen eat, Socrates? Still prisoner, old one. Two, painter, paint me a jail, mad watercolor cells. Poet, how old is suffering? Write it in yellow lead. God, make me a sky on my glass ceiling. I need stars now to lead through this atmosphere of shrieks and private hells, entrances and exits, in, out, up, down, the civic seesaw. Hear me now, always here somehow. Three, in a universe of cells, who is not in jail? Jailers. In a world of hospitals, who is not sick? Doctors. A golden sardine is swimming in my head. Oh, we know some things, man, about some things like jazz and jails and God. Saturday is a good day to go to jail.
27, I'm going to read a little couplet there. Sit here writing, not daring to stop for fear of seeing what's outside my head. Because when he saw what was outside his head and tried to do something about it as a union organizer, the whole weight of McCarthyism and the FBI and the U.S. police and political system came down on his head. He did get a Mariner's card right out of high school, and for 7 years he was at sea. And you spoke to one of his mates one time in a bar who'd been with him. And what did he tell you about Kaufman on shipboard?
Well, he was known for being quite fearless. Whenever there was an extremely dangerous, difficult job, like tying down riggings and during a storm, Bob was always the one who volunteered to do it. He was very strong and very fearless. Yes, he made a great impression on everybody.
He was a union organizer for the Maritime Union and head of a strike committee. And I wonder if he hadn't have been, if the FBI hadn't come down savagely on him, and the Maritime Union kicking him out for degeneracy, which is smoking marijuana, and the Coast Guard refusing to give him a Mariner's card because he was a subversive. Do you think he would have been a poet?
I've often wondered that. I think maybe he wouldn't have. I think that it was a profession of opportunity, that the time was right at a certain moment. And I mean, he had been blacklisted from the National NMU, National Maritime Union, and was working in the kitchen at a Hilton hotel in Los Angeles. and he read an article about the Beatniks in Life magazine, and he quit his job and went up to San Francisco to be part of that scene. And that was when he met his wife Eileen, and he began writing, and she began writing his poems down, and they started publishing Beatitude magazine. I don't know that any of that would have happened. Probably not. We don't know.
Well, you know that he continued always to love the sea and to find the docks his home. In fact, you talked about how he, when you met him, and he was a person whose presence was defined by absence and who seemed to be wandering. You described following him one day, and you followed him down to the docks. And
yes, I was in San Francisco. I was in City Lights Books, I looked out the window, and he was going by. And Bob was always walking very fast in a very determined way, and I always wondered, where is this guy going? I mean, he didn't seem to have much of anything to do all day. He was like Poe's man of the crowd. He was just wandering around, and I thought, I'm going to follow him. So I walked out of the bookstore, and I just stayed about a block behind him, and he walked down Kearney Street and crossed Market and went south of Market, went all the way down to the China Basin to where the docks were and the ships came in. And he stood there at a chain link fence, looking through the fence at the boats coming in and out and being loaded and unloaded, and for a long, long time. And I realized, you know, that was the old seaman, and he probably knew all the ships and what they were doing, and the flags and the names. And yeah, that was very important to him. In fact, I just realized reading the jail poems, there's a couple of lines there where he says, busy battening down hatches of human souls. Sea metaphors throughout his work.
Very
beautiful, very deep.
And I'm wondering if you would read the poem Rondo of the Sea, which I think tells us something about what he loved about the sea.
Right. Rondo of the One Sea, deep rolling Galilee, eternal seven ocean, named sea, endlessly flowing, holy sea, sea never stilled, all flowing sea, sea destroyer of Baal and Mammon, dried forever, dried sea, sea eraser of sea darks, remover of sea valves, evaporator of the evil ones, parent ocean sea, sea breaker of Ra's sea, broken and dehydrated forever by deep rolling Galilee, sweet green, wet blue, saltless sea, beloved Galilee, the green walking, blue walking, Jesus Christ, sea.
Okay, so at sea, it destroyed Baal and Mammon, and it evaporated the evil one's parent. He felt a freedom at sea. It was a sweet, green, wet, blue, saltless sea, beloved Galilee. And that was snatched away from him.
The language is pure alchemy. And it's really like Odysseus, you know? It's like the Odyssey. I mean, this is someone sailing around the world. And also the sea is the mother. It's extraordinarily powerful, deep work, and he's always pulling the blues in as well. It's remarkable. I never tire of it. You know, I've been reading him all these years. I mean, it's been a long time now that I've been reading him, for something like 50 years, and I've never tired of him. He's remarkable, and his humor stays funny as well. Oftentimes humor, especially humor from 50s or 60s, that long ago, it can lose its humor, and his never does.
Rondo of the Sea is the first poem that we're reading from the collection that you salvaged from the fire. The collection was The Ancient Rain. And can you tell us the circumstances? He was an oral poet. He had a huge amount of poetry memorized, and he would declaim other people's poems. William Blake T.S. Eliot and Charles Olson and Wallace Stevens, and then he would launch into his own poem, improvised on the spot. And all of his collections, the three collections, which are the three published collections while he was alive, are gathered in the Collected Poems of Bob Kaufman. And the last one, The Ancient Rain, which most of what we're going to be reading tonight is in The Ancient Rain, you salvaged from a fire. You want to tell us that story?
Yes. Well, the latter part come from that manuscript. The first part of the book were poems that I had just been gathering from little magazines, from people who knew him, who happened to save manuscripts. I'd been collecting them for quite a number of years, so I had basically an uncollected set of poems. And the question for me always was Bob still writing? It was hard for me to accept the fact that he would just give up poetry and not write. And yet he never read, and one never had any evidence of this. And one day I came down to the Cafe Trieste around 7:30 in the morning, and Bob was outside the cafe, and he was talking about Dante's Inferno, and I thought he was just speaking metaphorically, but he lived in the Dante Cafe, Dante Hotel, on Broadway, up above the Condor, and it had burned down. There were fire trucks outside, and it was still smoldering, and he was homeless at that point, lost everything he had in that fire. And so I waited a couple of days until finally the fire trucks left, and I crawled under the police lines, and I went upstairs because I knew where his room was. I'd hung out with him in his room quite a number of times. We'd look at art books and smoke pot and just sit on the bed, and we didn't do too much talking. I mean, he would talk, but it wasn't really a conversation. He would just say things that were very poetical. But he liked hanging out, and so I knew where his room was. And as I got closer to it, I realized the fire was probably in his room or very close to it. I mean, he might have just been smoking in bed, but the room was really burnt out, and there was a chest of drawers, and it was reduced to a pile of charcoal. And I started putting my fingers all through and crawling, kind of clawing through this still smoldering pile of charcoal. At the bottom, there was this famous Moroccan leather binder, which Mary Beach refers to in Golden Sardine, that he kept his poems in. And I opened it up, and there were all the poems inside, and they were soaking wet, and they were burned around the edges. We reproduced one of them in the City Lights book that just came out. And so I brought them over to City Lights bookstore, where I was working at that point, upstairs in the editorial offices. And I peeled them off one by one. They were still wet to dry out. And I put them all around the office. And around 9:30, Ferlinghetti came into work. And I still remember the look of astonishment on his face at all these manuscripts. And it was a great moment because, yeah, it was finally proof that Bob had been writing. And they were remarkable poems. I mean, I remember one, the manuscript said, "I am a camera, the soul, the poet nailed on the hard bone of this world, his soul dedicated to silence, is a fish with frog's eyes. The blood of the poet flows out with his poems back to the pyramid of bones from which he is thrust. His death is a saving grace. Creation is perfect." I mean, that poem, from the minute I read it, was burned into my brain. Yeah, utter memorability with Bob, and that's an important attribute in art, whether it's a painting or a poem. If it gets into your head and you remember it, memorability is an important attribute to great art, I think.
That poem, I am a camera, yeah. It, describing what a poet is. He's a fish in the ocean of his culture, and he has frog eyes. Does that make him a freak? Creation is perfect.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, it's a magnificent surrealist image, a fish with frog's eyes.
Right.
And he's got the pyramid of bones. And he's thrust from that, and he's got a kind of crucifixion that's taking place,
right,
and the blood of the poet, there's sacrifice. I mean, this is a man who gave absolutely everything to poetry. I'm sure there are still people like that out there. There are always going to be. I don't know who they are.
Yes, I have known a couple of them, and I can, you know.
Well, actually, when you are walking down the street and you see a homeless person and they're, you know, sitting out there on the street, you know, you should realize that that could be a great poet or a great painter or a great philosopher.
That's absolutely right. A poem that is not in Ancient Rain, but I wanted you to read Rondo of the Sea. What the sea represented was getting away from Mammon. And okay, this is on land. This is a benediction, which is on page 7. I wondered if you might read that.
Benediction. Pale brown Moses went down to Egypt land to let somebody's people go. Kept him out of Florida. No UN there. The poor governor is all alone with 600,000 illiterates. America, I forgive you. I forgive you nailing black Jesus to an imported cross every 6 weeks in Dawson, Georgia. America, I forgive you. I forgive you eating black children. I know your hunger. America, I forgive you. I forgive you burning Japanese babies defensively. I realize how necessary it was. Your ancestor had beautiful thoughts in his brain. His descendants are experts in real estate. Your generals have mushrooming visions. Every day your people get more and more cars, television, sickness, death dreams. You must have been great alive. That's an indictment.
Whoa.
That's unbelievable. You know, and this is somebody writing around 1959, 1960. Yeah. I mean, he starts out with a very bluesy kind of pale brown Moses went down to Egypt land to let somebody's people go.
Can you please read Dark Walking Endlessly? Let's see.
Do you want me to read the whole thing or just the beginning?
Well,
you want?
Yeah, it takes 2 minutes.
Okay, let's get into it.
Okay.
Dark walking endlessly these anguished floors of earth, through rainful seasons of the mind, past the foaming wave of broken into and entered eyes, riding black horses to the thin lips of the mind in a year of breaking Aprils. I come to that place there. My soul is moonburned, my body a sinewed hurt for all the nothing that I am, the nothing that is all my mingles of African hair. Speak for me. I weave the winds and kiss the rains, all for love. I dreamed an African dream. My head was a bony guitar, strung with tongues and plucked by gold-feathered, wingless, moon-dripped rituals under a midnight sun, drumming human beats from the heart of an ebony goddess, humming the melodies of being from stone to bone and from sand eternal. Blue rain falling in soft eyedrops from the nude bodies of dancing planets. Beats of science played on vibrated teeth of open-mouthed African harpsichords. Venus, the star jazzer in transit on fluted bars of black light, dancing in theaters of birds, streaming beauty's name beyond the belts. Mahogany goldfish blossom in thickly loaded skies. Down from the intimate distance by a river, where peace is green in the fountain, roses disappear into each other. The sun and the moon create the ballad at its source, and all those fires of love I burn in memory of. Higher than the tallest peaks, deeper than the steepest clouds, farther than the farthest seas, stand the serene kingdom of the truly fair, with her immortal children of the mind. The great rose of time turns slowly, the dream flown on wings of silver bells beyond harpoons and screech owl, gone far on beyond. The dream is on the heights and rising.
Ah, the dream is on the heights. And in 1975, he visited Oregon, invited by Wavy Gravy and Ken Kesey. He wrote a poem. Do you read Oregon and the untitled poem?
Sure. Oregon, you are with me, Oregon, day and night. I feel you, Oregon. I am Negro. I am Oregon. Oregon is me. The planet Oregon. The state Oregon. Oregon. In the night, you come with bicycle wheels. Oregon, you come with stars of fire. You come green. Green eyes, hair, arms, head, face, legs, feet, toes. Green. Nose green. Your breast green. Your cross green. Your blood green. Oregon, winds blow around. Oregon, I am green, Oregon. You are mine, Oregon. I am yours, Oregon. I live in Oregon. Oregon lives in me. Oregon, you come and make me into a bird and fly me to secret places day and night. The secret places in Oregon. I am standing on the steps of the Holy Church of Crispus Attucks, St. John the Baptist, the Holy Brother of Christ. I am talking to Lorca. We decide that the heart crane trip home to Oregon. Heaven flight from Gulf of Mexico. The bridge is crossed and the florid black found. These are very private poems. The meanings are very private. We are spectators. We're standing outside these poems looking in, and we can see deep into his soul, but we don't really know finally what all of this means. And that mystery is part of what keeps us coming back to these poems, I think. So it's followed by a poem called Untitled. The sun is a Negro. The mother of the sun is a Negro. The disciples of the sun are Negro. The saints of the sun are Negro. Heaven is Negro. Of course, the word simply means black.
Perhaps you can read two things. The excerpts from Ancient Rain, the excerpts that you've singled out that you wanted to read from that. Oh, on page 167, The Ancient Rain Wets My Face.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The Ancient Rain is a long poem written in the bicentennial year, which I guess most people don't remember, but it was a big deal. And there was a lot of patriotism, but it was also a very strange time. As Dylan points out in the recent film about Rolling Thunder, which was also a bicentennial tour, there was a lot going on in the streets, and someone tried to assassinate the president twice. It was a strange time. And so Bob wrote this great bicentennial poem, which is his view of America. The ancient rain wets my face, and I am freed from hatreds of me that disguise themselves with racist bouquets. The ancient rain has moved me to another world where the people stand still and the streets move me to destination. I look down on earth and see myself wandering in the ancient rain, ecstatic, aware that the death I feel around me is in the hands of the ancient rain, and those who plan death for me and dreams are known to the ancient rain, silent, humming raindrops of the ancient rain. The ancient rain is falling. The Washington Monument rumbles. The Lincoln Memorial is surrounded by stars. Mount Rushmore stares into every face. The Continental Congress meets in the home of the ancient rain. Nathan Hale stands immaculate at the entrance to the Capitol. Crispus Attucks is taken to school by Thomas Jefferson. Boston is quiet. The ancient rain is falling. Crispus Attucks, of course, is the first individual killed in the Revolutionary War in America, and he was black. So this is Bob's view of history, but Bob's view of history is the whole sweep of time. I mean, he starts in Neolithic and in the caves, right. And he goes right down to the present, and you always get that big sweep of time with Bob Kaufman. You get it with Gregory Corso too. And also The Ancient Rain, I always thought it sounded a little bit like A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. It's very much that kind of vibe. And of course, Kaufman used to read poems at the Gaslight Cafe in 61, 62. Wavy Gravy used to book the Monday Night Poetry Series there, and Bob was a regular reader, Kaufman. And Dylan, of course, was playing all his early concerts at the Gaslight Cafe. And I mean, there was a marvelous live CD that came out a few years ago of one of his sets there in 62. So I think there might be some crossover there. It's very much a Hard Rain's Gonna Fall type of chanting composition.
And I wondered if we might end with the human being poem.
Human being, yes, that is. One thing I want to say, Barbara, is I had two other editors with this book, Neely Cherkovsky and Tate Swindle. And Tate did a lot of work on pulling together some of the, most of the uncollected poems. He spent years, like I did, traveling around to libraries. He went to Paris, where there was a big collection in the Bibliothèque Nationale. And so I had two collaborators with this. And yes, Bob was, I don't think you can limit Bob in any way religiously, saying he was one thing or another. He was everything. But
he found comfort in Zen Buddhism, right?
Yes. There's a poetry reading in 72 that we have a tape, videotape of. And he says, when he begins the reading, I have tried to achieve in my poetry the state of pure Zen Buddhism. And at the end of his life, he came, Buddhism was a very, very important source of solace and faith and inquiry. I mean, he said he was a Buddhist.
Is that on YouTube, that reading?
Only a small excerpt. I'd like to put the whole thing up, but yeah. His son Parker didn't really want it up, and I'm working on that situation. So it's quite a wonderful reading. Okay, so we're going to read Human Being.
Right.
And this is pretty much Bob's last poem. At the very end of his life, Bob had a notebook, and he was writing these beautiful poems in it. And the last time I saw him, he and Lynn Wilde, his companion, they were homeless. They were living in a van up by the Russian River, and he had the notebook with him. And then when he died, Lynn inherited it. And then Lynn died in a hotel somewhere south of Market. And at that point, the notebook was lost. Fortunately, about 9 poems out of the notebook were reproduced in little magazines at the time. And the rest of them were gone. So this is, in a way, his last poem, Human Being. It has a epigram. It says, "Just let it be as it naturally is. Tulku Urgyen Rinpoche." And the poem reads, "There is nothing more relaxing than the present moment. Just right here, nowhere else, for once. Do not linger in the past. Do not look to the future. Do not face the facts, since they will make you think. Leave it. Let it be. The mind becomes so full, we forget that it is open. Thoughts will come and go, if we allow. Just let them go about the business of illusion on their own. If you think them real, gently look at where they come from. No one's home. See, now you are free to be." And that's a beautiful way to end a great career.
And it's a beautiful way to end this program. I think this was wonderful. And thank you once again, Ray Foy. The book, A Labor of Love on all of the editors' parts, is Collected Poems of Bob Kaufman, published last year by City Lights Book. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Barbara. Good night.
Bye. Thank you. Radio Lost and Found on every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight, right here on KBOO.